This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. I was asked to talk today about working together to support the most vulnerable bereaved children, which was, as you probably gathered by some of the comments I was making earlier, I do struggle, actually, with the concept that for any child, the death of a parent or brother or sister isn't a very significant event. However, I have stuck to my brief, and I'd really like to think about the reality is that there are some families we work with, and some children in particular, who have got a much more complicated bereavement journey for lots of different reasons. And I suppose one of the things that I worry about as a service provider is that we do get quite binary about how we kind of think about vulnerability. So, you know, if we had to kind of think together about what makes a situation vulnerable, you know, there may be we have floating in things. You know, is it because the child had pre-existing social, behavioural or emotional difficulties? Is it that they've experienced multiple previous losses that therefore render them more vulnerable? You know, are they in a looked-after situation? Typically, those children have had many of the other losses we've talked about. Are they young offenders? Do they have particular learning differences or difficulties? We've got a very good workshop on that later on this afternoon. You know, what makes vulnerable? Or, you know, for me, is it about the child's age? When I came into this field, there were very few services for children who were not verbal. So if you were 2 years old and your mum or dad died, there'd be very little opportunity to kind of support children. So age, equally, I think there's a huge sector of, in terms of 16 to 18-year-olds, I still am very curious about whether we reach this age group, particularly for boys. I think partly we've got some more men in the room this afternoon, actually, but I think this morning we only had maybe one or two. But we are a predominantly female, white, middle-aged profession, aren't we, who drive the child bereavement sector. And, you know, we also, and I take responsibility for some of the, you know, we come from, a lot of our interventions are quite arts and crafts based. Well, you know, if you're 16 to 18 and a guy, that's just not going to float most of your boats. So we've just got to start thinking much more carefully about how we engage, I think, some of the vulnerable groups. Typically, I think the type of death, suicide, murder, is often seen as quite a complicated death to make sense of, and I will talk more about that in the presentation. But equally, and I would say this based on my background, comes from palliative care, children are living with serious illness in their families now, particularly where a parent is being treated for secondary cancer. That can be for 5-6 years, even with a liver secondary. That was unheard of, you know, when we started. So I think, again, it's a sort of assumption that we sometimes maybe don't say it out loud, but sometimes we think that a sudden death is somehow harder than a death that you've had time to prepare for. But living with what is now a chronic, serious palliative illness in your family for all of those years, for many years of your childhood, often leads to quite strained and difficult relationships. So, you know, we need to think about the type of death. And then the nature of the relationship. You know, did you get on with the person who died? Was that a complex one? So now that we're really clear that absolutely we are talking to the converted in this room, there's no point preaching to you about how to do things. That's why people have prioritised coming to this conference 2 days before the biggest wedding of the century. I know that because I shared a taxi cab with a woman in a Union Jack feather boa from Texas. I was thinking, gosh. No, we're here because we actually really do want to make a difference. And I think, you know, thinking about vulnerability, what we need to think of ourselves is what can we do? Who do we need on our teams? When we're working with a particularly vulnerable child, how can we engage whether it might be a teacher, it might be the child's surviving parent, it might be a doctor that you work with or a head teacher who's very resistant. How can we bring key people involved? You're not going to do it on your own. Even if you're a quite brilliant therapist, you on your own are not going to pave a journey through a complicated grief process for a child who is acutely vulnerable. So one of the things that I wanted to just think about in your challenge for how you bring people into your team to work with these vulnerable children is I just want to kind of talk to you about this equation, P equals C times A squared, which it comes from the sort of business sector, really, and we talk about P is performance or productivity, and C is capability or competence, and A is attitude. And what's really going to be what's going to make the biggest difference to you in terms of the people you bring on board is your capacity to influence the attitude of the people that you bring into your team. So if you can influence the attitude of a head teacher who thinks whatever, or a mother who doesn't want her 14-year-old boy to be told that the dad is dying in a hospice, it's not the competence of these people, it's the attitude that they bring in. And I just want to flag up, these things have all been said, but we live in a world where people have thoughts in their head about bereaved children that we don't have these thoughts, but we have to help change these thoughts in the people that we work with. So one of the predominant things that goes on is I might or I will say the wrong thing. You know, that is a very disabling thought. This is highly specialised work. I couldn't possibly do it as well as people who really know what they're doing. This was actually said to me by a head teacher, and she said, it's not my job to meet the emotional needs of children. And again, we kind of shudder, but it's interesting the context in which that was said. This was a six-year-old child whose father had been shot on a Sunday evening at home, and he'd come back into school several weeks later, and this little guy, who was, I think he was year one or two, kept shouting out in class, my daddy's been shot, my daddy's been shot. And the teacher, who was trying to manage the situation as compassionately as she could, was also very aware of how disruptive it was being for the class, but she obviously also wanted to try and meet the needs of this young boy. And it was interesting when I, because it actually came through as a formal complaint, the head teacher phoned up and said, you have no right. The teacher had phoned the helpline, and we'd been giving her some advice, and then the head teacher came through to me and said, you've got no right to request my teachers to have to engage with this kind of stuff. And that's when she said, it's not my job to meet the emotional needs of children. Now, the reason for me saying this is I've never actually heard another teacher say that. So this isn't about teacher bashing at all, because I could give you countless examples of superb practice. What I think I challenge you to do is how you respond when people say these things. What do you do? Okay, do you go back and say, well, that's bloody ridiculous then, isn't it? You know, how do you think they're going to learn? Or do you try and engage with her anxiety or whatever, you know, and I don't have the time to go into what that conversation was about. But I do think when somebody says to you, I might, you know, they are so vulnerable, they could break, I could make them cry. We have to think really carefully about what our responses are to these kind of statements. You know, they could get really upset and that wouldn't be okay here. If a teacher's saying to you from a school that's quite formal and academic, we were having some really interesting conversations in our seminar before, you know, it may not be okay, especially if you're 16. You may not want to break down and cry in front of your mates. So we need to think about how can we make that okay. So what we've got to start thinking about is when we're trying to engage the people who will help us with the most vulnerable bereaved children is what are our responses to these kind of things? How can we help people develop a great attitude? So the attitude squared stuff is, you know, I really try and engage people in the curiosity that we have. You know, I really want to understand the meaning of this death for this child and the key people who'll be around to support them. I will form a thinking partnership with those involved to understand what the child and the family really wants to happen. Try not to make assumptions about, you know, what's going to be right or wrong with this situation. You know, I will be curious and creative in my thinking to enable the young person to generate solutions that will take them to a more productive place. And I think, and something I feel really strongly about is, you know, I will work really hard to increase their sense of belonging. You know, if you're in a situation where your mum has been murdered by her boyfriend who you didn't like anyway and you witnessed that, you know, what can I do to help that child realise or meet other children who've been through similar situations so that they can have some sense of the fact that they can kind of find a way through? So what can we do to reduce a sense of isolation? Often vulnerability is very much about isolation, which is why peer support and group work for bereaved children, I think, is... it's difficult to deliver, it's difficult to fund, it's difficult to organise, but we have to persevere and try and do it, because meeting others is a very key part. This, you know, trying to build the scaffolding of peer support so that they can meet others through similar situations. So if you're talking about vulnerability, the first thing we need to do is actually look at how... this is why I just... I get nervous in funding climates where we are trying to... you can hear it's coming through already. You know, Debbie and I were talking about this. It's coming through from the government is, well, we'll only fund the really pathological grief. Well, you know, what are we... how are we going to actually make those decisions? You know, so we need to know that the meaning of this particular situation for this child in this family. You'll see in a moment a little clip from a young guy who his situation, I think in terms of the death, you would definitely classify as very vulnerable. This is a piece of film from 10 years ago, and his mother poured petrol over herself and set herself alight, and she burned to death, and it was a suicide. And what's interesting is that you would score that very highly in terms of type of death. And yet, in many ways, because of the journey and because of lots of factors that happened in his life, and particularly because of his father, who was an incredibly positive influence in stabilising family life, he's probably less vulnerable than a child I worked with last year who was from a very middle-class family where there had been, you know, quite a non-public history of domestic violence and chronic ill health through a motor neurone disease situation. But you would have looked at one family and said, that's vulnerable, and that isn't. And that... so... again, just to highlight that we have got quite an interesting kind of booklet around how to do a family assessment to do this. And so in terms of thinking about vulnerability and children, one of the things I'm very struck by is how children are, how they do process and remember information. And I had the opportunity of meeting a young girl who I worked with when she was 10 years old. And in my experience, I would describe her mother's death as one of the most difficult deaths I ever witnessed in palliative care. And the mother died by what's called faecal vomiting. And it was, in terms of a sensory experience, the smell was very difficult. It was visually very distressing to see somebody literally vomit faeces before she died. And I met her, this young girl 10 years later, and uppermost in my mind was, you know, what kind of complications might she have about that, what for me was a very distressing death. And this is the comment about, it's not what you've actually experienced, it's what you remember. And what she actually... I said, what do you remember about your mum's death? And she said, God, you know what I remember? I remember about Mr. Jones bringing me home from school. I was on a field trip. I got home just in time. And I remember when I walked into the bedroom, you said, did you see her eyes move? Because she was in a kind of unconscious state. And I think she smiled. That was her memory of it. She had no memory whatsoever. So again, we have to be careful about when we make these assessments, and also how we can help children to... how we can promote a reduction of the vulnerability through building up resilience. Just very quickly talking about Natasha, who was a young girl I was asked to see. She was 14 years old. By the time I got to see her, she was in an inpatient unit for teenagers, and she was severely self-harming. She was cutting her forearms and virtually mute. She had no story. And I went in and tried to engage her in just telling me a bit about what had happened. and she found it very difficult to talk. And I just gave her these three stones, and I said, you know, this is a rough rock, a smooth pebble, and a gemstone. And, you know, some memories are actually really rough and difficult. And I said, just hold, tell me what's going on, Natasha. And she held it, and she said, well, I killed my mother. And her story began with that title, and that is what I would argue made her vulnerable, not what actually happened. What made her vulnerable was the fact that she had created a story in her head, which, I mean, the reality was that she'd had a row with her mum over ironing her skirt before breakfast, and her mum had left a bit late, and she had been killed in a car accident on the way to work. But that's a kind of simple example where, in this field, we can help children re-sculpt the story through doing some... Because I said, you obviously meant to kill your mum then when you were having that row. She said, no, of course I didn't. And then kind of worked with it to sculpt a different story. So a child, a resilient child, when we talk about vulnerability, a resilient child is not a child in a particular set of circumstances. It's how they tell their story, how they remember it, and what they, you know, I've, as I said, seen children who've been through some very traumatic situations, but they've learned to tell their story, and we've kind of helped them shape their story. And equally, when they've met others, one of the kind of key things about kind of peer support and meeting with other children who've been through the same stuff is you do a lot of upward and downward comparison. And again, it's a hideous example at one level, but we do a lot of work with children bereaved by murder. And I can remember talking to one youngster afterwards, and he said, God, I thought mine was bad, but at least they didn't use axes. and in a way, that was kind of helpful to him to kind of think, you know, a knife was pretty good, actually, in that situation. So part of what we're doing is really trying to coach children to rehearse a narrative, a story that promotes resilience. These are some little cards. I've got examples of people want to have a look at. But just sometimes you can just start children off by doing forms of CBT. These are just little cards which you start with a small beginning. So in this example, it says, I regret that we had an argument on the day you died. It was a stupid, silly thing. It doesn't matter. What matters is that we loved each other. So if you can change a child's title story from I killed my mother to actually I regret that we argued, however, we loved each other, you go on a very different journey. And then there's some other examples there. The other thing that I think we need to kind of really think about when you're working with a very vulnerable child is some of the solution-focused work. Sometimes it's very overwhelming for those you might be supporting because they've just got so many problems. You think, where do I start? And that's where I think the solution-focused therapies are really quite helpful. For example, if you had to give a score out of 10 of how comfortable you feel telling your story about mum or dad to a friend that you really, really trust, what would it be? I remember talking to a guy, and he said this was his dad had died by suicide. And he said, oh, it would be 2 out of 10. I said, what, even to your best mate that you really, really trust? He said, yeah, 2 out of 10. So I then said to him, well, what's getting in the way of that being 8 out of 10? You know, what could we do? Try and scale it up. And how can we help a great mate understand how you really feel about your dad's death? So one of the things that sometimes we have to do when we're working with a child with multiple losses who's highly vulnerable is get away from the why. All the words in my presentation that are in red are the kind of danger words. You know, you could spend a lot of hours of therapy going through why. But actually, for children, we're in a particularly a funding climate now where a lot of access to that kind of help is much more difficult. So what I'm encouraging people to think about is to what is it that you really want? What do you really want? And how can we help you get it? If you kind of focus in on that, even a child that you might only see once, you may take them in a different direction. Because I think one of the things we're going to really seriously need to be looking at now is quite short-term interventions, if you like. And don't underestimate how useful a half an hour conversation can be between a teacher and a child. I mean, I'm so lucky because I hear them tell me, years later, they will recount a conversation that somebody had. And some teachers, you can just give them some of these ideas, and the child will much prefer to talk to somebody they know than a stranger in a clinic that they have to wait 6 months for an appointment for. Mm. And then they don't reach the criteria, so they feel let down. I think one of the big clues to what I would call the children that I believe are the most vulnerable is not type of death and all of that kind of thing. I think it's those who have very ambivalent relationships with the person who died. So this was a sign-off from a letter of a little guy who, I think he was about 12, and his father had died actually before he was born. He'd shot himself. So it was a difficult death. It was a suicide. And he didn't, it was quite hard for him. He didn't have any memories of his dad because he hadn't even been born. And so when he was doing the group work with the others, he actually decided to write a letter to his dad about what would have been a kind of perfect day for him. So he'd kind of written, oh, you know, we'd go to McDonald's and then you'd take me to the cinema and then we'd do a bit of go-karting and then we'd watch this on the telly and da da da. And it all sounded really straightforward, actually. And I thought, oh, you know, he's coping quite well. And then at the end, he just put, from Jack, P.S. I love you, I hate you, I love you, I hate you, I love you. And when I and he was still quite monosyllabic when we read it together, and then he did write at the end why, and I said, that's really tough for you, isn't it? And he just broke down in tears. So sometimes it's the ambivalent relationship that can cause the greatest degree of vulnerability in children. And this is another example. This is another example. This is a guy, again, those of you who work in palliative care. This is a great example for me of team working when I talk about getting your group together. The person who was in charge of the group of us who helped with this, a young man whose father was dying, was Tricia. And she was a staff nurse on a busy acute ward in a general hospital. And Tricia was intuitively brilliant around people. People warmed to her. I don't think she probably had done very much counselling training or anything like that, but she was confident and she knew when to call you in and she knew how to engage with people. And she had been the one person on the ward, really, who had kind of spent time in this side room talking with this guy called Bill. Oh, called Bill. He was 52. And he had very few visitors. There was clearly an extremely frosty relationship between him and his wife. And his son, who was 15, wasn't visiting. And Tricia just said at the time, she said, can I just talk to you about this guy? Because his pain control is not good. And I just sense there's something we could do that might really, I don't know what it is, but let's just have a thinking partnership about what we might do. So I sat down and I said, well, okay, first of all, you and I both go in the room together because he's not met me from Adam and we'll just think about. Anyway, the outcome of it was that he said, you know, I've just been, there had been a background of domestic violence within the family. The son had witnessed him being very violent towards his mum. Yet, ostensibly, he was a successful businessman who was quite respected in the community. And the son hated this, the fact that, you know, he was this, he was that. But actually, at home, particularly after drink, it was very hard. And this was something that Tricia and Bill and I just kind of wrote. It took about half an hour. And he says, dear Mark, I know that I haven't been a reliable father and I regret so much all the violence that you and Mum grew up with, especially after I had been drinking. I never managed to live without the drink and now I think that I may only have a short time left. I want you to know that I'm so sorry. Try to remember the good times that we did have together and forget the rows. I said many stupid things I didn't mean, and I'm really proud of you, son, always have been. Live your life doing the things you love and with the people who matter most. Look after your mum and good luck with the football. Love, Dad. Now, you know, the outcome of that was not that Mark didn't visit him before he died. There wasn't any, you know, warm embraces or anything like that. But the outcome of an intervention like that was that when we did start to work together, well, first of all, he went to the funeral, which I think he probably wouldn't have gone to the funeral. He was absolutely fueled with anger, this young lad, and getting quite involved with kind of soft drugs and stuff like that. But I think that it meant that we started the kind of cognitive work that we needed to do to help him in his grief journey in a different place, because his father had acknowledged some of the stuff that he needed. So again, it's just for you to be creative about, as I say, that's 30 minutes, didn't cost a lot. It very much stemmed from a confident staff nurse getting, you know, just having the confidence to kind of think, what could we do? How could we kind of move this forward? Just very quickly, I want to just talk about bringing together young people who are experience the same type of traumatic deaths. And to decodify that, I'm really splitting that into two main types of death. Well, I suppose three, possibly. But I'm mainly thinking about murder, bringing children together who've experienced a murder, because it still is fairly rare. There are only 400 murders a year. So we, at the moment, we run a national program at Winston's Wish. We take children, we take referrals from all around the country. Obviously, it depends on the family's capacity to travel. We don't run the groups all around the country, unfortunately. They're run in two separate sites. And we also do the same for suicide, which is much more common. I mean, suicide is I think, 13% of our referrals at the moment. And then the other group that we're just starting to do now is around military deaths, which, again, is another kind of death that you're not likely to kind of bump into your mates necessarily who've had the same experience. If I can just hold it for a moment. I just want to show you... Actually, how many minutes have I got?
Three.
I'm not going to show you this, but I'm just going to move on. No. No, I tell you what we'll do. We'll come back to them in questions if we've got time at the end. Yeah? Is that all right? No, because it's too long. It's 4 minutes, I think, the whole film. But I do want to flag up, just to keep the chair very happy, a paper that he wrote recently. David and Danny Nugas from Winston's Wish have done a really excellent evaluation of some of the murder work. I'll show you a film if we have time. It's a four-minute film. And
if you'd be nice about my paper, you can show the film.
Can I?
Everyone could be talking around
somewhere.
I feel smooth, but I know what's going on. It's fine.
Okay. No, we'll come back if we have time. No, it's just one of the things that David has been brilliant about is trying to drive us as a field to evaluate what we're doing and get some, as well as the qualitative measures that we are perhaps stronger at doing, also get some numbers. And so I just wanted to highlight, A, the paper, which is volume 30, I think, of Bereavement Care, 2010, because it does give you some concrete data. But one of the things about, just one of the practical things about doing group work with children who are quite traumatised, and one of the things that taxed us a bit at the beginning, and I know certainly taxed people like Dora Black, was whether or not being in the group with a, you know, hearing other stories would traumatise children more. So I'm pleased to tell you, our experience at the moment is that it doesn't. You know, I'm not saying it doesn't shock children, but the benefit of actually just being around people who are able to tell their story in an authentic way seems to have a really positive impact on children. okay, I said about that. Right, I do want to, if I can, just show you, we've talked a bit. I think as a field, it's quite difficult about whether we do bring children together in this, with the same types of deaths. And this is a clip from this is 10 years old now. Can I hold it? Can I hold it for a moment? I'll just show a couple of minutes. This is a little boy who's in a group. This is in a place called the Wilderness Centre, where he's on a weekend with 25 children who have experienced all types of deaths. And his story is the young guy that was part of a 10-year follow-up that I talked about, whose mother died by pouring petrol over herself. So it was a suicide death that he was trying to tell that story. I just want you to kind of look at the impact sometimes of telling your story when you are actually with other children who have got sometimes more straightforward stories to tell. And I have to say that all the children will have had, you know, he certainly had individual work to prepare him before, but it is quite a challenge sometimes sharing your story. So the more homogeneous we can make our groups, the better. Thank you. If we can just...
Camp Winston takes place at a youth and community centre in the Forest of Dean. All the children who come here are bereaved, but 1 in 10 are here to remember a person who has died by suicide.
It just gives us a big, open, spacious environment in which children can be themselves and express themselves in lots of different ways, doing lots and lots of different activities. We try to mirror in the programme the concept of children going in and out of grief, in and out of puddles. So we give them plenty of things which the child will experience as quite fun, uplifting activities, and then often follow that by something that's very focused, maybe giving them space to deal with some of the more painful issues.
Like a book. Some of you might be very good at drawing pictures. You might want to do your story using pictures.
You want to do another? Do you have to do some writing?
If you want to do some writing, it's entirely up to you. You might want to do it all in writing.
The first day of the camp is about remembering the person who's died and how they died.
And she just done a backflip down the stairs and she knocked her head on the stair gate. I knew what I had to do. I went down the stairs and I jumped over my mum and I told my sister to look after my little baby sister. And I went to find some help at my friend's house.
My mum came back with the police and the police followed my mum in the car. And she told my mum and... No, my mum told my auntie and my auntie broke down.
And then... My uncle came back and my mum said, why didn't you bring him with you? And I'd done a picture with him at hospital and the nurse and my mum, but I didn't go.
Can you tell us what happened to your mum?
I was at police station.
I think in telling a story, there's always a kind of lead up to that story. So the child is listening, often very closely, to what other people are saying and transferring what they're hearing to their own experience. And sometimes when it gets to them, they just feel almost overwhelmed with emotion, just sobbing and sobbing, just to let it out. But what they need to know, what's most important about that, is that that extreme of emotion is accepted by the group, that it is a normal part of grief. The sobbing does stop, and you need, as the adult in the situation, I guess you need to have confidence that it will stop, that life will go on, and that the child then doesn't feel embarrassed to actually experience that emotion.
I'm going to stop now, almost on time. So just finally, the point I just want to highlight from that is that Tom, as I said, it's lovely meeting these children 10 years on, so I've had a chance to sort of say to him, and he did actually after that go to a group where he met all young people who died by suicide, and he wasn't traumatised by it. You know, he never said, why did you send me to the group where, you know, it was. He doesn't even remember it like that. But I just, when I look at that video, I just think if we can make it as kind of possible and as comfortable to help children. This is a kind of picture of a bridge over swampy ground. Gillian Chowns talks about the swampy ground of complicated grief, where you're never quite sure where you're going to tread. And our job is really just to try and help people build a bridge. And I think for me, when we're talking about vulnerable children, it's about how you all, how we all, you've got, you know, I don't know, perhaps 50 potential leaders in the field in this room now. You know, how can we make good great? What does really great leadership look around how we're supporting vulnerable children? And, you know, by the end of today, having looked at all the different workshops that you're going to kind of visit and think about the various vulnerabilities, you know, I just hope that you would have a what I would call a contagious belief that other people will pick up from you, that children absolutely can be guided through this very kind of swampy ground of more complicated grief and trauma. I completely believe that. And I think that if you believe that, other people will pick it up from you. And if you ever want a thinking partner to kind of think through any particularly vulnerable children that you've got, there are, as you know, a number of national helplines. The Winston's Wish one is open Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. We will be very happy to kind of just think through with you what the individual issues are for that particular child in that particular family, that particular community. Thank you.